your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
You wouldn't think it would take a study, let alone many studies, to convince employers that offices beat cubicles. After all, for time immemorial, the upwardly aspiring employee saw the office, especially the corner office, as the brass ring. And it seems incontrovertible common sense that the noise and the lack of privacy in cube farms, which the spin micsters, by the way, antiseptically dubbed open workspaces, outweigh the benefits of increased collaboration. After all, even if you're in a walled office, there's phone, there's email, there's text, and yeah, there's the door. But convincing employers to build walled offices has taken studies and is still taking studies, multiple studies. And indeed, many employers still aren't convinced that good fences make good neighbors. Such employers remain seduced by the low upfront costs of cubes and that it's easier to spy on employees who are making personal calls or playing on the internet on the organization's time. HR types and egalitarian activists like that workers and bosses are equal, even if suffering equally. Down with hierarchy. Fraternite, egalite, liberte. Off with the bosses' heads, or at least their offices. Or, to be ideologically balanced, a more conservative exhortation, tear down those walls. And even if some offices remain, the symbolism of decreased hierarchy pleases the people and their advocates. To make their pitch more palatable to the bottom-line-oriented suits, activists sold the notion that replacing offices with egalitarian-ish cube farms promote collaboration, which will spark bold, fresh, creative ideas. Ah, the synergy of group input. But the activists were a little less likely to mention that collaborative efforts are more costly, and they're more time-consuming. And they often lead to the tepid, lowest common denominator decisions that everyone on the so-called team can tolerate, while eviscerating the pride of ownership that often drives an individual to work diligently. The garden variety worker was seduced to accept cube farms because employers often tossed in startup culture sops like a foosball table, a ping-pong table, flea-free doggies allowed, and a fridge that's stocked with Red Bull for the morning and craft beer for the late afternoon, or not so late afternoon. But the studies, they were a-coming. A University of Sydney study made 42,764 observations at 303 office buildings. For all that cost, they found what I could have told them for free. Private offices had among the five or six different office layouts studied, had the highest satisfaction rate, and open workspaces, the lowest. The biggest complaint, again, no surprise, the noise in open workspaces. More surprising, satisfaction with what they call ease of interaction was no higher in open workspaces than with private offices. And just a few months ago, a Harvard study reported even more compelling findings, that face-to-face time decreased by 70% when an office converted from offices to open workspaces. And that, they hypothesize, is because many people crave getting away from all that interaction. Georgetown professor and author of the Coin's now really truly best-selling book called Deep Work, and I'm hoping to get him on the show soon, his name is Cal Newport, he wrote, "To make these numbers concrete, in the 15 days before the company's office redesign, participants accumulated an average of 5.8 hours of face-to-face interaction per person per day. After the switch to open layout, 1.7, down from 5.8 to 1.7. That's an astonishing, and I'm still quoting him, that's an astonishing 4 hours less collaboration per day in the open environment that's supposed to encourage it. And what should be a rude awakening for the bean-counting executives, employees at the studied companies reported that their productivity, as defined by the company's own performance management system, declined after implementing open workspace. More studies. A Queensland University study found that working in open workspaces, and I'm quoting here, quote, causes high level of stress, conflict, high blood pressure, and high staff turnover, end quote. A study in the Journal of Environmental Psychology found, quote, enclosed private offices clearly outperformed open plan layouts in most aspects of indoor environmental quality, particularly in acoustics, privacy, and proxemics. Proxemics, by the way, refers to the amount of space that a person needs to feel comfortable. I'm continuing to quote now. Benefits of enhanced, what they call ease of interaction, were smaller than the penalties of increased noise and decreased privacy. Indeed, I should say a little bit about privacy. Everybody wants some privacy. For example, the ability to, heaven forbid, call your sweetie on company time. That's less doable when there's a coworker in a cube 2 feet away. Now, despite this pretty darn compelling evidence, I am betting that the move to offices is going to be slow. Employers tend to focus more on cube farms, easy-to-see short-term cost saving, than on the longer-term, harder-to-pin-down loss of efficiency and, of course, employee satisfaction. Also, activists like the reality and the symbolism of workers and bosses getting the same thing, even if it's a lousy cubicle. But at some point, when employers learn about the study after study confirming the obvious, that cube farms' noise and lack of privacy results in less employee satisfaction and productivity, and, I haven't mentioned this yet, that good employees, the ones who are able to get better jobs, the ones that the companies and nonprofits and government most want to retain, they often leave for more halcyon surrounds. When that all becomes top of mind for employers, then I believe, no guarantees, that the trend to offices will accelerate. And at least there's going to be, you know, higher, the cubicles are going to get, you know, walls that instead of just being 4 feet tall would extend all the way to the ceiling. So there'd be a little bit more privacy without much cost. And that way, at least, whether it be offices or these high wall cubicles, that will result in workers, whether they be the peons or the poobahs, will be able to hear themselves think. And when employees choose to collaborate, even if they have private offices or high walls, they can simply get up or pick up the phone or email or text. There are myriad ways to communicate without forcing everyone to smell each other's farts. Anyway, that's my case for closing open workspaces, but I'm curious as to your reaction. As usual, I like to really hear diversity of viewpoint. So if you think that open workspaces, cube farms, are a good thing, I'd be particularly interested in hearing from you. Or, of course, we all like to be agreed with. So if you think that cube farms are overrated and the walls should be erected rather than having cube farms, I welcome your call. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And calls are already coming in, so I'm just going to wait a second. We're going to go right to the phones as soon as we can get. Those of you who don't know, I don't do call screening. We take calls at a really democratic radio. We take them in the order received with no screener, and I've never been burned. So it means you guys are great. So let's go to the phones now. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? What's your reaction?
Hello, am I on?
You are.
So just to offer another viewpoint on this, I understand what you're saying. Even the word cube farm has sort of a little bit of a negative connotation.
True.
But to offer another viewpoint, I work in an architect's office, and with seven or eight relatively soft-spoken people in a kind of a larger, relatively large domestic-type room, I find it way better. I really like it because we work fairly silently anyway in our work that we do, and when we talk on the phone, we can just subtly hear what other people are saying, and sometimes we can offer suggestions to people when they're on the phone. I've even done something like write something on a post-it and suggest, oh, you could say this while you're talking. So in this particular situation, I find it just great. I love it. And I think it has the social side of it. I find very positive, and I could see where if people were listening to music or if people were talking more loudly, it could be difficult.
You are an honored member of the Work with Marty Nemco workforce. I love intelligent disagreement. I think that, unfortunately, is so absent in today's so polarized times. So let me thank you very much for the call. I think you've added a great perspective.
Thank you.
Take care. And now I'll give the phone number out one more time if you want. I'll give it the phone number whether you want it or not, but you can call if you want. If you want to either just talk about your experience in an open workspace for good or ill, that's great. Or, as usual, a core purpose of this show is to do what I call workovers. If you or someone you love has a work-related problem of any sort, and to be honest, the more difficult, the better, the more challenging, whether you're 16 or 76, whether you're an entry-level worker, an unemployed worker, or you're a CEO in a for-profit or nonprofit world, I love your questions, I love your problems, and I do my best to help. I call them workovers, but no pummeling is involved, usually. The phone number here for a workover, or to tell me what your experience has been in an open workspace, the phone number is 415-841-4134. That's the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. We do have other calls, so I'm going to, again, just wait a moment, and we'll go right to the phones and take more calls, because people want to talk about this, which is great. Okay, welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
I think cubes can work if there is an option to work from home. So if you need the quiet time, the focus, then that can be achieved through either working from home on Fridays or Fridays and Mondays, whatever arrangement
I love that because I am having more and more clients say that they are exhausted by the time they get to work. Because the traffic is ever worse, and even if you take mass transit, getting to mass transit, waiting for mass transit, taking for mass transit, getting pushed like sardines, then walking or taking another bus to work, you're exhausted by the time you get to work. So, yes, telecommuting avoids the noise of the cube farm and allows you some space to work in a quiet environment, and heaven forbid, to do a little bit of personal stuff during your day and then maybe make it up at night. So I love your call. Thank you very much for calling the show. Let's go right back to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hi, it's your turn. Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
So I just like to add that I work in an open workspace environment, and I've noticed that when you're in the zone and it starts getting a little loud, especially if there's a big group talking, I notice that it kind of just, it gets me off of, out of my zone, if you will, of that workflow. And so I've noticed, and I kind of looked around at today, it's funny, it's happened today, I looked around and was observing others, and it seems to me that they also, some others, you know, that were also working and concentrating, they felt the same way. So what they do is they start putting the headphones in and kind of trying to drain out the noise or, you know, block out the noise. So I was kind of wondering to myself, like, can we be more productive and stay in that zone if we had cubicles, or maybe just, like you were saying, a designated area for collaboration, and then we can kind of go away in our private spaces so that we can be productive.
That strikes me as the triad would seem the perfect environment, where everybody gets, it doesn't have to be a big office. It could even be, you know, just high walls and no more cubic feet than in a cubicle, but where it's soundproofed and quiet. But that indeed that there is conference rooms, collaboration rooms or whatever, and telecommuting if for... There are just times I really think there is no reason in the world for an employer to insist that workers come in. Collaboration can occur by phone, Skype, email, text, etc. And just to make sure that they're working, it seems overly oppressive, especially with the traffic so terrible here in the Bay Area. It seems like having those set of choices is fair to both employee and employer. What do you think?
I agree.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
You're welcome.
Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Beautifully, actually.
Excellent. I am calling in because I heard you talking about this on the way home from the city to Marin.
Right.
And I was coming from an office that I just helped plan and design in the Presidio. In a house from the 1890s, an old officer's building. So it very much has walls and private spaces, and it also has a living room and a proper kitchen.
Sounds awesome.
It feels like a house.
God, sounds great.
And it's excellent. And it just, in the process of this project, of designing the space for the people who are going to work there, putting collectible things in there, like very homey feeling. It's been a luxury, and it's been therapeutic for me, having come from the Cube Farm culture.
Ah, so you've seen both sides. Tell me about your experience in the Cube Farm.
In the Cube Farm, I will echo what other people have said. I just felt like people tried to avoid each other instead of collaborating.
Explain why that was.
I think that it's trying to get things done, but also trying to keep up the appearance of getting things done. When it's natural for human beings to work hard for a little while and then take a break and do some online shopping, call your sweetheart. You know, we need that kind of push and pull. And when everyone's watching you, and at any moment your boss can come in and be behind you, you're ill at ease, and you're just putting on a false kind of sense, which carries over to your interactions with your coworkers.
There's another factor that I've heard about, is that many in certain work cultures that tend to be just social, where certain organizations hire people who are social, for example, in marketing or sales. And so, you know, they are by nature social. They like to be social. And it's like putting temptation in front of them. You've got all these people there to chat with. And so it's too tempting to not work, but play. Does that have any resonance of truth for you?
I think so. Yeah, definitely. As someone who's an extrovert and has worked in marketing and is very social, and that's part of my persona. And so it's difficult not to flirt with people,
right,
male, female. It's like you want to be that kind of person that shakes people up a little and talks to them more. But then, yeah, it feels very, difficult to kind of be both those things, productive and social.
And even if you're being social just because you know that, unfortunately, in our world where relationships and office politics matter, even if you'd rather work, you say, oh my God, if I don't want them to think I'm not social, and then, you know, and you pay a price in terms of your career because of it. So there's yet another reason to be social when you really don't want, and therefore, ultimately less productivity.
Exactly. I mean, my last job that was in a Cube Farm, it ultimately came to an end because they said, we think you're wonderful and you care so much about all the people here,
right,
but you're not a worker bee.
Right.
Like, you just don't care about getting that spreadsheet done. You'd rather make sure that so-and-so is okay and take them into the bathroom and console them. We wish we had a position for you like that. So, but this new space that I've been working on, it's really great because I find that people come out of their offices and they meet in the library and they sit on a comfortable couch, and you actually can feel the connection and then go back to your space. I think we need that. We need that kind of flexibility.
No, you're in the Presidio, so I think the Presidio only would rent to nonprofits. So, was there any pressure from the funders to say it's inefficient to be spending on a house? You know, you should be having cubes. Why are we spending all this money on luxury surroundings? We donated money because we want to help the environmental cause or whatever the hell it is. Did you get any pushback from anybody about having the workers in a house?
Well, I'm actually working in a nonprofit, but it's on the other side where we're funders. So our whole mission is social justice, and we're a family foundation. So the family funds a myriad of social justice causes and community organizations in the Bay Area. And so actually one of the family members, it was their idea
Wow.
This is also a it's a convening space for the
Amazing.
Nonprofits that we're paying for.
So many nonprofits I know, so many funders would say, no, we want to, you know, if we're about social justice, we need to help the poor and the homeless. What are you doing living in this fancy, fancy old Victorian or whatever while there are people starving? And they, and yet the funders said, no, you live in the, you have this nice house in the Presidio. Amazing.
Well, the door is open to those organizations that are working among those populations. So part of the space, half the space, is completely open to them using it for free for convenings for their members.
Okay.
So
anyway, I really thank you very much for the call. A very interesting call. Take care.
Thank you so much.
Yeah,
bye.
Let's take one more call about the summer change topics. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. Do you want to opine on open workspaces, or do you want to make a workover about to help with your work life?
This is Bruce. Am I on the air?
You are, Bruce.
Hey, great, Marty. Good show.
Thank you.
I want to give a different perspective, much like the architect earlier.
Great.
I'm in education, 40 years in schools, currently a principal, administrator the last 20, but I've been a teacher as well.
Mm-hmm.
What I like about it is that the faculty room,
mm-hmm.
where teachers can move out of their classroom into the faculty room, is generally open.
Sure.
And it's generally used in quite a good way. Now, if you're an administrator or, say, a department head, you probably would want, you know, a closed office because there's confidential meetings that you have. But in the field of education, this idea of openness and having a faculty room that's inclusive is the way to go, I think.
You well, know, there's no question. Nobody would argue. I mean, a break room, whether it be the most stuffy, you know, corporation or a school, there's a break room that is clearly designed for communication. The question is when work is supposed to be done, as in those corporate and nonprofit workspaces,
mm-hmm.
you know, should the work be going on? By the way, but there's an analogy here, because there
mm-hmm.
was a time when indeed the they did tear down the walls of the classrooms and had what
indeed.
Was called the open classroom.
Yes.
Right,
yes.
In the pods. I remember in
yes.
Marin County, they had this big, they had four or five classes in this one geodesic dome. But then they
yes.
found that it was chaos, and they
yes,
closed
exactly.
they closed
yes.
them for that reason. So
yeah,
maybe that's
yeah.
an interesting example of why.
Well, I would think the same research applies to those schools as it would in the workplace.
Right.
It can be chaotic, noisy. Does work get done efficiently and effectively? I would the research suggests the other way.
Right, exactly. Anyway, a great call. Another useful perspective. Thanks a lot for calling Work with
Marty. Okay, Marty. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Okay, so now I'm going to turn to another topic, but I always want to make sure that if you have a work-related problem in your own life or that of someone you care about, that you can call in and get for free what I charge reasonably, not free, during the week. If you have a work-related problem of any sort, you have no idea what you want to be when you grow up, even if you're already grown up, or you're well ensconced in your career and are saying, is this all there is? Or you're facing retirement, any of those things is fine. And I feel like doing this. The first person to call with a work-related problem is going to get a free copy of my book, published by Wiley in 2018, Careers for Dummies. So the phone number for a workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Now, as I promised, I'm going to turn to another topic. I am, you can probably tell from my voice, but anybody who knows me knows I am assertive. Nobody would call me a passive person. It's in my DNA. But as I look back on all of the efforts I've made where I've gone beyond what the average person would do to be assertive, I am not sure that that assertiveness has been worth the effort. So I decided in preparation for this show that I was going to try to make the case that assertiveness, which is so widely advocated by every self-help guru, I'm going to make the argument that it is overrated, that assertiveness is overrated. And as before with the issue of the open workspaces, I'm going to invite you to call in and tell me if you buy my argument that assertiveness is overrated or not. Not so long ago, the ideal comportment, I guess that was the fancy word, was to be restrained, modest, not pushy. But recent decades have seen increased praising of, indeed training of, assertiveness. We're even seeing encouragement of rude aggressiveness, which would be exemplified by such slogans as, I'm loud and I'm proud. Well, from where I sit, at least, neither extreme is right. You know, the mild one, which is the meek shall inherit the earth, or the other extreme, I'm loud and I'm proud. Neither one, I believe, are defensible. The question is, where in that broad middle should you aim for? Now, it probably depends in part on your predisposition. Some people seem hardwired for assertiveness, like me, I feel. Other people seem hardwired for compliance, or their early childhood conditioned them into compliance and eagerness to please. But certainly some of our level of assertiveness is under our control. Most people exhibit their level of assertiveness unconsciously, but I think it's wise that we make such decisions consciously after due deliberation. So what I'm going to do now is, I guess I'm going to try to be fair. I'm going to offer kind of a pros and cons for being moderately above average in assertiveness. I can't make the case for being, you know, aggressively rude, as, you know, I find I'm loud and I'm proud really obnoxious. But I'm going to make the case for moderately above average assertiveness. And then I'm going to make the case for moderate restraint, the more, you know, the meek shall inherit the earth. And maybe it'll help you get clear on where you would like to aim for on that continuum, especially in your work life, but more potentially, more broadly. So first, I'm going to make the argument for being assertive. Look, remember, it's unlikely that anybody is going to advocate more for you than you. You have to ask for what you want. In fact, I remember somebody who went to Harvard told me that at orientation, a speaker said that crucial to success at Harvard is to ask for what you want, and when they say no, to ask somebody else. Now, on the other hand, I'm going to make the argument for more restraint. If you push more than average, you're likely to encounter resistance, even antipathy. I mean, think about who likes the pushy car salesman, right? Or the person who's pushing hard to get a date to go to bed with them. The reaction is usually negative. And that negativity is especially likely when you are dealing with a Christian, which is the U.S.'s dominant religion, and that seeps into secular values, people of any religion. The New Testament, again and again, doesn't just say the meek shall inherit the earth, but they stress not being too willful, even urging extreme passivity, as in Matthew 17:20, which says, quote, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to the mountain, move from here to there, and it'll move. Nothing will be impossible for you. I mean, think about what kind of passivity that's encouraging. But in total, no matter what your religion, if any religion, on average, being understated works better. That's an argument for more restraint. But now, on the other hand, in favor of a more assertive position, being more assertive, if you're assertive, you are more in control of your existence. You are doing life rather than having life do you, and getting buffeted with the winds and being taken advantage of by people who are taking types, who try to take advantage of passive types. And study after study finds that control and autonomy are core to your happiness and to reducing anxiety. On the other hand, now I'm going to argue for more restraint. That is true, that control and autonomy are core to happiness and anxiety reduction, if your brand of assertiveness is usually well received. Many assertive people unwittingly are too intense, like me, and therefore I get rebuffed a lot, or they unwittingly make unreasonable asks and statements, and they often pay a big price. For example, I recall a client who is overly confident in the rectitude of his proposals. In fact, he's usually misguided, if not out and out wrong. I also recall an average performer at work who had heard that women should be more assertive in asking for a raise. She was assertive, and her boss, who was also a woman, was surprised because that boss perceived this employee as just an average performer. Not only was the employee turned down for the raise, but the boss felt that as a result, the employee was disgruntled. In fact, she acted disgruntled, and that she had an overinflated sense of self. So when layoffs were considered, that employee was put on the list. On the other hand, again now advocating for assertiveness, that argument is cherry-picking. In general, assertiveness is going to result in getting more for yourself and for others for whom you advocate. Like, let's say, don't you think that the assertive fundraiser or the assertive lobbyist is going to get more for their cause? But on the other hand, I'm going to argue for more restraint. Again, who likes pushy salespeople? But there's one more point I should make that is arguing for more restraint. Being assertive is not just risky, but it's stressful. It requires a lot of effort for what over time may yield little or no net gain, maybe a net loss. I mean, now think back to your own life. As I said at the top of this, I was thinking back to my own. When you've made a greater than average effort to be assertive, has that for you yielded a net gain or a net loss? And if it was a net gain, have those efforts caused enough of a gain to have been worth the effort and the stress of being quite assertive? So I've done my best to lay out pros and cons of being assertive, and I'm kind of arguing that assertiveness may be overrated, but it's a variable with the individual. So in light of those pros and cons, do you want to be any more or less assertive? Do you want to be any more or less assertive in general or with a specific person or situation? So now I'm going to invite you to call. Do you think assertiveness is overrated? What has your experience been with being more assertive than average? The phone number to weigh in on what you think about assertiveness and whether it's overrated or not, the phone number here at KALW and Work with Marty and Emco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And as usual, if you have a work-related problem, if you are stuck in your work life in any way, I invite you to call for a workover. I'll do my best to help you. The phone number here again, 415-841-4134. Those of you who are regular listeners to the show know that I like tweeting because I consider tweets an excellent repository of your best ideas and of retweeting others' best ideas in a minimal amount of time. I consider it a highly effective approach. And so I'm going to share with you some of my favorite recent career-related tweets. But we have lots of callers on the line, so as usual, I like to prioritize you. So let us go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It is your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi there. I'm calling to do my best to answer your question. I actually feel that it's a little bit of both, that it depends on the person yourself.
It being assertiveness. For those of you who are just joining us, we're talking about the wisdom of being more assertive than average.
More assertive or less assertive. And you're saying, you know, having more restraint on assertiveness, you're asking about that.
Yes. That's wise.
So I think that it actually depends on how well you're capable of being fear-based or love-based.
Tell me more.
So that if you're in a state of some anxiety about something, and you tend to be a person who's not assertive, you would want to work with getting in touch with you, the part of you that can accept yourself and believe in and really care about yourself, to just, from a place of your heart, do your best and not be attached to the outcome. Mm-hmm. And if you're on the other side and you're a person who's too assertive and maybe you push people, you know, don't like you because you're too assertive, mm-hmm. You know, you might ask yourself, am I being so assertive and people are running away from me because I'm trying to prove something, because deep down I'm a little insecure and I want to make sure I'm flashy enough that everyone will like me and promote me. So I think it depends on if you're fear-based or love-based and which side of the leaning you're on as far as how assertive you are or how not assertive enough you are.
I think that's a great point. I think, you know, we all strive, and you mentioned the kind of, it's like being in the moment. It's like, instead of thinking about, you know, that you're a fearful person or an assertive person, being in the moment, and if something is cosmically just, if it's right, being assertive, but not in a way that brings out too much emotion. If you're too pushy about it, if there's too much emotion attached to it, it's going to be a turnoff. If you're fearful and you're sounding fearful, then too timid, that's going to come off. So it's the very difficult question. If you are blessed with an even-tempered personality, like my wife is, everything is going to come out with an appropriate level of assertiveness. But if you are if you are plagued with being too fearful and therefore reticent, or too fearful and therefore compensating by being too aggressive, or otherwise being too aggressive, it's going to be hard. But it's a great goal to strive for, to be assertive on the merits, not let the emotion, positive or negative, drive you. Does that summarize your point pretty well?
Yeah, I think so. And I really appreciate you taking my call.
Of course. It was a wonderful call. Thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nimco.
Thank you.
Take care and be well. Let's take one more call on this, then I'll change topic. I'm going to go back to the tweets I promised to give you. So welcome to Work with Marty Nimco. What's on your mind?
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
Beautifully.
Oh, great. Okay. Good old iPhone.
yeah.
My name's Diane.
Imagine 50 years ago, I told somebody that you would be able to have in your pocket something that will search this thing called the internet and get you basically any information you want, watch any videos you want, make phone calls, even contact friends instantly, text them, and no wires needed. They would put me in Napa State the mental hospital. And yet today,
you know what? I'm old enough to remember those days when you couldn't do this. So I'm still, although I've been using these for years, I'm still impressed with them.
I am too. Anyway, please go ahead.
Yeah, I think my answer is a little bit echoes some of what I just heard, but I think it requires a nuanced answer, because for me, I am capable of being assertive or not assertive, it depends. And I think for me, it depends on who or what I'm dealing with on the other end.
Mm-hmm.
And there's times when, like, for example, one thing I've had to learn, if you're dealing with a bully type of person, not to back down and be a wimp, which I was in my childhood, just push back, be solid, hold your ground. Quiet. You don't have to yell, but if you're solid and assertive with a bully, they generally back down. And then on the other hand, there's times when someone like me can be trying to take over a room or want my way, and I've had to learn to stop, be cooperative, be collaborative.
Right.
And, you know, so if you're chameleon like and you can do different things, you have to tune in. The idea is to listen and interact with people, and not just go charging in because you're so smart and you know it all, you know.
Yeah.
And a lot of us are very complex people, you know, like part of me is assertive and part of me can be a wimp. So
yeah.
Trying to be appropriate in the situation, depending on the personality and whoever I'm dealing with, that's what it's really about.
To add another layer of nuance, sometimes you win the battle but lose the war in being assertive. Let's just take the example of a bully, which, by the way, you know, somehow the media has made bullies always seem male, but there are ways that women can be bullying too, and sometimes, So, but you have to look not only at whether you win the battle, but whether you lose the war. So, in other words, let's take a stereotypical example. If I have a boss, and I think my boss is dead wrong, and I tell the boss, you know, I think you're dead wrong. I may nail him or her to the cross with all the data and all the logic, and I may win the battle, and I may get fired. So
Well, that's an interesting issue about people who are in power or whatever, but there's this thing of being political, not in terms of national politics, but your life. What are your goals? You don't want to be a doormat and be stepped on, but sometimes the point is you don't have to fight every battle. You can go, wait, this is what I want. Let me say the right thing to let this work itself out. And
Right.
Yeah.
And that's
instead
not just
flying off the handle.
That's not just true with bosses or in the workplace, but think of how often, I mean, the good parent doesn't fight every little battle. You know, if the kid wants, you've got a 3-year-old and the kid wants to wear mismatched clothing, you know, is that really worth going to the mat about? So it's, you know, again,
right.
You know, knowing when to be assertive and when not to. So
that's the famous expression, pick your battles.
Exactly. Well, thank you for adding nuance to this discussion. I appreciate your calling.
And thank you. Okay.
Take care. Okay. I was going to offer tweets, and I am going to offer tweets, but if you've got a work-related problem, the phone number here for a workover, 415-841-4134. That's the number here. Work with Marty Nimco and KALW, 415-841-4134. So as I said, I love tweeting because it's an excellent repository of my ideas, and I can quickly read other people's ideas and retweet them if I feel they're worthy. So, but I wanted to share with you some of my most recent crop of tweets that are related to career. And our first two are about choosing career. I've got like four different categories. I have couple on choosing career, a couple on searching for a job, I have a couple for on the job, three for on the job, and then one about learning, which of course is crucial to staying employed and staying fresh. So first, around choosing a career. A person gets many, many more career choices by choosing to live in quite modest housing. And the advantages of having those career choices usually far exceeds the benefits you'd get from living in a fancier place, because so many of the more rewarding careers don't pay well. A lot of careers pay a lot because they're not that much fun or creative or interesting. So by choosing to live in most modest housing, you're able to have many more career choices. So that, again, I'm not saying the tweet, I mean, obviously this was longer than 280 characters, but here I have the luxury of fleshing it out a bit for you so it's clearer and with a little more nuance added. Okay, the second tweet that I wrote about choosing a career is, I wonder, if I had dropped out in the ninth grade, dropped out of school, and kept learning, because I love learning, but I only was learning what I cared to learn, and then began writing essays, selling them on the street like the poetry lady, and later posting them on the internet, and maybe doing radio or podcasts, you know, and clearly I enjoy doing radio, might my life, which would thus be devoid of a lifetime of school crap and employer crap, might my life net have been more satisfying and more contributory? So that was a tweet I wrote about choosing a career. I guess it also relates to education, of course. I guess while I'm on learning and education, I'll share my tweet about that. People seek out other people, and especially they seek out travel to enrich their lives. Yet, in our own room, we can experience the best thinkers, the best entertainers in books, in magazines, and in TV, and more broadly still with the amazing internet, especially with Google search, which gives you curated videos, that is, those that are most watched, most linked to, curated videos, curated movies, curated articles for free. No hassle and no cost. One more learning thing. This is a little more cynical. I've seen so, and this I didn't write in the tweet, but I'm sharing it with you. I've seen so many graduates of art schools and music schools be in mountains of debt and unemployable, just not making any money from their art. So my cynical little tweet was, art school, four-year, six-figure summer camp, alas. Okay, now turning to the job search. An under-discussed key to landing a job is to be not a salesman, but a statesman. How do you do that? Reveal a weakness or two that would militate against your doing the job well. That will eliminate you from jobs at which you'll likely fail and gain the interviewer's trust, which, of course, is crucial to being selected. So that was that tweet, and that pretty much stands on its own. Another job search tweet that I wrote recently, this is not mine. This was a retweet of Adam Grant, the University of Pennsylvania professor of business who was on the show at some point. Anyway, his tweet was, to understand the culture of an employing organization, you know, a company or a nonprofit, to understand the culture of, let's say, a company, before you join it, ask employees there, or use Glassdoor, I'm adding, to tell you stories about things that happen in that workplace but wouldn't happen elsewhere. That's a really good question. I'll say, read it now exactly as Adam Grant wrote it. To understand the culture of a company before you join, ask people to tell you stories about things that happen there but wouldn't happen elsewhere. And you can do that during the interview process. It's a great, you know, a lot of my clients, when they're going for a job interview, they say, what's a good question for me to ask? Well, that's a great question. Tell me a story about something that happens here in this workplace that might not happen elsewhere. Or when you're offered the job, as I've often recommended, come in to negotiate terms and hang out in the break room and ask that question of employees as they come in. Hey, you know, I've been just offered a job here. You want to tell me a story about something that might happen here that might not elsewhere? It's a really good way to understand the individual culture of the place. Now I want to talk about three tweets that I wrote about how on the job, so keys to success. But again, I want to give out the phone number. If you have a work-related problem, call in for a workover. This is the time to call. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4800. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I'm reading a Dorothy Sayers mystery novel called Gaudy Night. Wonderful. And she's got a quote in there that I ended up tweeting. It's the work you're doing that really counts. So in other words, it's not some what you wish you were doing, but this is, again, one of these kind of a Buddhist thing that's odd for English Dorothy Sayers back in the 30s to be writing this, but I really love it. It's the work you're doing that really counts. Now, I've got more of these, but I'm going to go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Well, I actually had a thought about one of your tweets that I wanted to just offer a reflection
Great.
On.
Yes.
You were talking about not overstepping the housing. You know, that you can talk about all kinds of life expenses, but that's obviously the biggest one. Mm-hmm. That it gives you more flexibility in career choice.
Right.
There's another thing that that does. Of course, it's hard to find affordable housing, particularly here in the Bay Area
yep.
right now.
Yep.
But if you're willing to share housing with others mm-hmm. or take a year or two and still live with your parents, whatever mm-hmm. it takes, mm-hmm. And you're earning something, mm-hmm. It allows you to put away some money in the bank that gives you a lot more freedom of choice about the jobs you're going to take.
Good point.
You know, it means you don't have to take the first job. You don't have to be a wage slave if you've got a nest egg put away.
Love it.
And I think that's, you know, I would wish that for everybody. So
right.
I just wanted to pass that on.
I love that. Money buys freedom. Money is not, it's not so much to buy crap, but money
that's
buys
right.
freedom to do what you want with your time. I mean, I don't get paid on this radio show. Because I am, I don't spend on a lot of material things, but I don't worry about not getting paid on this radio show. I have that freedom that comes from not being a big spender. And to use your example, if I were living at home with my parents or in very modest digs with roommates or in a dicey neighborhood, you know, the actual increased risk of my getting assaulted in that dicey neighborhood, as long as I wasn't prancing around in the middle of the night, is very small, but my savings are enormous. So
right.
I totally agree with you. Thank
and
you.
And you know, mm-hmm. and I guess the other, you know, corollary of that is mm-hmm. that long term, you know, making real investments, not investing in a flashy car or an expensive hat, but investing in things that actually can you know, education. You know, if you're so fortunate as to save enough money, real estate, that investments can that produce returns, are much better ways to use whatever resources you have than consumer goods.
I want to agree and disagree. Too often I'm seeing that the investment in education no longer pays like it used to. Of course, the old data was you earn $1 million more if you have these degrees, but that was in a day when a relatively small percentage of people went to college. Now it's de rigueur, and so in an era of where there's so many people with college degrees and there's ever more automation, offshoring, part-time, and temping, I'm not convinced that the education investment, at least traditional expensive education, is worth it. Of course, taking a course on Coursera or, you know, through adult school or, you know, through an extension program or edX or Udemy or LinkedIn Learning, those are bargains and those are great investments. But when we think of education, we tend to think of university-based, you know, big-time expensive education, and I'm not so sure that that's clearly a good investment. In terms of
I think the data certainly supports that point of view, but I wasn't really referring to you know, a VA necessarily. I was thinking about education and areas that you're interested in that could further specific career paths. Although, you know, I would disagree that, you know, the purpose of a college education is not just
of course not.
To give you, you know, a better income, although you hope it will, but also to improve the quality of your life.
Of course, in theory. That's exactly what they promulgate on their brochures and their websites and their PR people. But unfortunately, if you really read the syllabi and you see how much reading and how few students actually do the reading that they find relevant, how little the classes are so huge so that the amount of actual critical thinking and tough questioning and Socratic method a la Professor Kingsfield in Paper Chase is really tiny. And that's not just anecdotal evidence. There was a major study called Academically Adrift, which studied thousands and thousands of students across the country in a whole wide range of college, and they found little or no growth in reading comprehension, critical thinking, or writing. So, you know, let us not get seduced by the marketing crap, even though it comes from that icon of goodness, supposed goodness, the higher education. So I'm a huge fan of learning, and I absolutely agree that learning should not be just about careerism at all, but connoisseurship of life.
Sure.
But taking a course in literature or in philosophy or ethics that you take for free or near free online or in person or a meetup. You know, there are philosophy meetups, one in Berkeley and one in Walnut Creek, where people read really interesting bits of philosophy and then exchange like it was a class, and it's free. That's gold. And I think
I appreciate your thoughts and, of course, your expertise in reading about education. I think there is a lot of university education, the large lecture hall, no professor contact, none of the Socratic method, etc. And I guess we have to be consumers, thoughtful consumers, when it comes to even, you know, getting a BA. My daughters went to community college for several years and got tremendous benefits for nothing. For nickels,
exactly.
You know?
I need to riff on this. I've done it before, but it's so central. Hiring at community college is almost exclusively based on how well the instructor teaches. At universities, ironically, paradoxically, the more prestigious the university, the more likely the higher professor is to be hired and promoted independent of how well they teach. In fact, and this is a fancy word, inversely correlate with their teaching, but how much research dollars they put in it, and how much at their cutting edge esoterica, which makes them tends to be more nerdy types who are not transformational instructors. So your experience with your daughter is the norm. The quality of teaching in generally is much better at a community college and at almost no cost, and yet we are such a status-oriented, designer-label-oriented society that people pay much more for a worse education or for a pair of designer-label jeans with some stupid label on the back that cost $300 when a pair of $20 jeans from Walmart was just as good. I think education, I've said this so many times, is America's most overrated product, except for community colleges and courses through extension, online, etc. So forgive me.
I really appreciate that. I'm a Harvard grad, and I had awful instructors.
Exactly.
There.
Exactly.
So I can really speak to that. And I've taught at the extension, UC Extension, and know the other teachers in the courses, and they're tremendous.
Exactly.
So
I
get your point. I really appreciate it. And thanks so much for everything you do. It's just wonderful hearing your thoughts, and take a very humane and humanitarian kind of a perspective on things. It's very refreshing.
Thank you. It is a privilege. Believe me, you can hear it in my voice. I've been doing this now almost 30 years. It is a privilege to do it. I look forward. I'm actually quite a sad person by nature, but every time it comes to Thursday and I think about coming in here, I feel good.
Mm-hmm.
It's a privilege to do it.
I'll tell you, nothing better than helping other people out to feel. Get you out of a rut.
So. You're totally, you know, and I'm an atheist, but, you know, when the Old Testament, the New Testament, I believe, says it's better to give than to receive, I find it absolutely true.
Yeah, that's the point.
Right.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for everything. I've enjoyed you for many years.
Oh, great. Thank you. And feel free to keep calling back with whenever you have some idea floats through your brain.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye.
Bye, Marty.
Okay, I've got no more time for calls, but I've got a couple more of these tweets that I promised I would give you, so let me share those with you. And I was talking about some tweets about for on the job, and as I said, I tend to tweet whenever an idea comes to my mind that I think is not same old, but fresh and concise enough to put in 280 characters. So this is a tweet I wrote about on the job. This evening, a client asked me how I manage to answer my emails so promptly. Foundationally, it's because I recognize that behind the bits and bytes of an email is a human being who would feel valued and respected if I answer promptly, and a person who feels disregarded when I don't. I keep that in mind. And I don't mind working longer hours. It doesn't feel like work. Even though it's not fun, I would rather watch a movie on Amazon Prime Video or play with my doggie or hang out with my wife. But I will always, not always, but I will usually say I can't leave my desk until I've answered all my email. So no matter how late it is, I am answering the email, and then I can guilt-free go and play. And I think that's sometimes a useful tool for the many procrastinators among us. We all would rather play than work. But if we have a foundational sense of responsibility to our readers, to our employers, to the cosmos, and realize we must work before play, as corny as that sounds, that's a real, if you have that foundational belief, you're going to be far less likely to procrastinate. Okay, just one more of these tweets. And this, again, is another retweet. This is not mine. It comes from a person named Hiten Shah. He writes, "One of the worst recurring problems that companies of all sizes have is keeping people around who aren't working out." Perhaps the iconic book, business book or employment book of the 20th century was From Good to Great. And the most quoted statement from that book, From Good to Great, is the key to a workplace being effective is getting the right people on the bus. You can't, of course, I'm butchering his quote, but it's something like you shouldn't steer the bus until you get the right people on. So anyway, I find that a very important point. The previous caller used the term humane. Sometimes the most humane thing to do is indeed to cut your losses. Very often an employee who knows that he or she is weak really doesn't have the courage to quit. But by gently counseling them out and perhaps guiding them into helping them get a more appropriate position, you are helping that person, you are helping the coworkers, you are helping the customers. And so that's why I really liked Hiten Shah's quote there. We repeat it again. One of the worst recurring problems that companies, actually nonprofits, government agencies, of all sizes have, is keeping people around who aren't working out. That's the kind of assertiveness, the ethical assertiveness, that I think really is very, very wise, again, if you're thinking in the cosmic scheme of things. Anyway, that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Think about the calls. If you've been listening to this show tonight, think of how thoughtful, intelligent, and varied the calls have been. It's wonderful. Anyway, please join me again next Thursday at 7 p.m. You can call in for a workover. Plus, my wife, Barbara Nemco, and I are going to talk with Christine Waldenberg. We're going to talk about one of the more common green self-employment opportunities, running a consignment shop. Until then, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.